Good evening. My name is Peter Crowe. I'm the Dean of the School of Foreign Service, and it is my privilege on behalf of the school and the Department of History to welcome you to the renovated Gaston Hall and to an occasion this evening at which we honor an established institution and inaugurate a new one. The established institution is Professor Carol Quigley, whose teaching has quickened and disciplined the minds of generations of School of Foreign Service students. His inspired lectures over a span of 40 years, delivered to literally thousands of students, have for these students defined the school, their education, and frequently themselves. This series of lectures, which Professor Quigley begins this evening, enables us in several senses to recapture the past and to illustrate a legend. It gives us the opportunity as well to reassemble, to be educated once again under the spirit of this awesome, some would say downright formidable, intellect. It is an occasion as well to inaugurate a new institution at the School of Foreign Service, which is the Oscar Iden Lecture Series. This lecture series has been endowed through the creative philanthropy of Oscar Iden, School of Foreign Service class of 1924. This endowed lecture series is intended by him to sharpen the school community's view of the world and the U.S. role in it. And we thought of no better way to initiate this series than to entrust it to Professor Quigley, who knows more about the world than any man we know. Professor Quigley, the stage, Gaston Hall, and this audience, I am confident to say, are now yours.
Dean Crowe, ladies and gentlemen, and the people who laughed at that. For a decade from 1931 to 1941, my chief intellectual concern was with the growth of public authority and the development of the European state. I dreamed at that time that at some date in the future, perhaps 30 years in the future, I would write the definitive history of the growth of the European state. But in 1941, I had to postpone indefinitely and gradually abandon that project. I no longer, after 1941, had adequate libraries, and it would take a very extraordinary library for the purpose, of which there are only a couple in the United States, perhaps. I was much too busy with my teaching, which I enjoyed thoroughly. But above all, I discovered that other historians were so specialized in their studies and were so lacking in basic historical concepts, such as, what does state mean? In what way is state different from many other things? Such as public authority, government, and so forth. That they could not understand what I had to say. And I had a bitter experience which revealed that. Namely, in my doctoral dissertation, which was on the public administration of the Napoleonic Kingdom of Italy, which I wrote between 1936 and 1938. I will not go into the story, I will simply say that there was only one man who read it who had the slightest idea what it was all about, and that was the great University of Florence historian, Salvemini, who at that time was a refugee in this country. But most historians knew only one country. They knew England, or they knew France, or they might have known Italy, or they might have known Germany. And most historians knew only certain periods. And, of course, the period I was writing about, the Napoleonic Kingdom of Italy, was technically from 1805 to 1814. And anyone who knew that period, I discovered, really didn't know anything about what the situation had been like before the revolution, the French Revolution of 1789. So instead of writing that, I got into what I suppose was really my much stronger activity, the creation of the necessary conceptual paradigms, structures, frameworks for understanding historical processes. Because I discovered that historians could not even understand their own specialties because of their lack of concepts. Let me give you two examples of this. One of them very contemporary. That is, it's the last 100 years, which for me is contemporary. There is an area of political activity. And for about 100 years, and in all political argument and controversy today, there is a basic assumption that only two kinds of interests or entities operate in the area of political action. That is, individuals and the government. There have been numerous books published with such titles as Man versus the State. I know two of those. They both appeared, I think, in 1906. We hear about big government as a threat to the individual, and so forth and so forth. Conservatives now are telling us that we must curtail government, cut government spending, cut government powers, reduce government personnel for the sake of making individuals more free. Liberals, on the other hand, are still telling us, as they have for a long, long time, that in order to make individuals free, we must destroy communities. By communities, I mean villages, ghettos and cities, ethnic groupings, religious groupings, anything which is segregated. We must destroy them so that all individuals would be, if possible, identical, including boys and girls. But the area of political action
and I won't draw it on here, but just assume a circle of political action in which you have government, individuals acting in there, but you also have at least two other groups, really three others, voluntary associations, which I'll say no more about, corporations, and communities. And if the liberals destroy communities for the sake of the individual, and the conservatives destroy big government for the sake of individual, you're going to have an area of political action in which irresponsible and immensely powerful corporations are engaged in opposition to individuals who are socially naked and indefenseless. And what we get in history is never what anyone is struggling for. What we get in history is the resultant of diverse groups studying, struggling. And if liberals and conservatives are struggling for these things, that was what the result will be. That's one example of a lack of a paradigm. I've given you the paradigm. The next one is more current. A number of years ago, an old friend of mine, we were colleagues at Princeton in the history department in 1936 and 37, wrote a book, The Age of the Democratic Revolution. Now, since neither of the revolutions that he talked about were democratic, neither the one in France nor the one in the United States were not intended to be and did not turn out to be democratic revolutions, people have changed this and talk about the 18th century revolution. But they talk as if the 18th century revolution in, let's say, the United States and France and in other places was the same kind of a revolution. Now, Bob Palmer is a very industrious person with a very agile mind and a ready verbalizer, but he does not know what he means by revolution or by democratic. And he's totally wrong if he believes the 18th century revolution in the United States or the English-speaking world in general was the same as the 18th century revolution in France. In fact, they were the opposite. The revolution in France was a struggle by a government which did not have sovereignty to obtain sovereignty, which to us would be the essential identifying characteristic of any state, sovereignty. The English-speaking revolution through the 18th century and in the United States very clearly was an effort by states who had sovereignty to curtail it, divide it up, hamper it by such things as federalism, separation of powers, electoral colleges, and so forth and so forth. Now, this is what I mean by the need for paradigms. The basic entity to understand is the civilization as a whole. And although I give you the date that I'm going to talk about the last 1,000 years, Western civilization, of which we are a part, has been around for a considerable time longer than that. I think we might say, perhaps, that Western civilization began around 600. It came out of the ruins and wreckage of the preceding classical civilization. And classical civilization's dates might well be 1100 B.C. through a dark age in 1000 B.C. And it ended about 550 A.D. and was followed by a dark age around 850 or 876, 100 years before the outline begins this lecture. Out of the wreckage of classical civilization, which was the shores of the Mediterranean Sea, that was classical civilization, and it was held together by the fact that the ease of water transportation on the Mediterranean was so superior to the difficulties of land transportation away from the shores of the Mediterranean Sea, that the city of Rome could bring its food from Egypt when it could not bring food from Lombardy in Italy. And anywhere in the Mediterranean Sea, even at the height of the Roman Empire, if you went into the interior a few hundred miles, you had left civilization. That civilization perished, and out of the wreckage came four other civilizations: Islam, Byzantium, Russia, and Western. And I think we might say they all were sort of around from 600 onward, and certainly by 950 they were around. Now, another paradigm that I want to establish is a difference between two kinds of civilizations, which means a difference between two kinds of governments in these. Asiatic civilizations generally do not attempt to deal with individuals or with the problems of individuals. I have always called that Class B civilization. Class A civilization is the kind of civilization that classical civilization turned into, the kind that we are moving toward and have been from the beginning, or the kind that was found in the first Chinese civilization, which was from 1800 BC to 400 AD, and to distinguish it from the Chinese civilization, which was from 400 to about 1930, we call that earlier one Sinic, S-I-N-I-C, from the Latin word for China, which is Sinia. In those Class A civilizations, although the civilization starts by being an area of common culture made up of communities, in our type of civilization, there is a long-term trend to destroy and break down communities. Now, the way I would like to express it would be, on the back blackboard, by saying that all civilizations start out as aggregations of communities. Those communities are generally of two types: either local, such as parishes, neighborhoods, villages, manors, or whatever they may be, or kinship communities, families, clans, and so forth. And at when civilization begins with communities such as this, as ours did in 600, let us say, there is no state. And there is no atomized individual. Now, I won't go into the details of this, but in such communities, everything is different. There are no written laws. It's all customary. All controls, or most controls, are what I call internalized. That is, they're built into your hormones and your neurological responses, and you do what is necessary to remain a member of the community, because if you weren't a member of the community, you would be nothing. You would not be a man. And as you may know, if you've ever studied linguistics, many of the names which primitive peoples have, or even not quite so friendly people, have for themselves is their word for man. That is, unless you were a member of their community, you were not a man. Now, what happens in the course of civilization, and it may, like in ours, take 1,000 or more years, it took 1,500 years in civic civilization, and it took about 1,000 years in classical antiquity, is that those communities are broken out and gradually break down to smaller and smaller groups, and they end up simply as what we call nuclear families, the father and the mother. And then you understand they lose all of their discipline and control of their own children. And the owners and controllers of property become isolated individuals and so forth. And what happens is you end up with a state which is not only sovereign but totalitarian. And it is filled with isolated individuals who face a totalitarian state. The communities, of course, from which classical antiquity came were clans, that is, the kingship group. The communities from which Western civilization came were local villages and manors. And indeed, the communities always are either one or the other. And lucky civilizations, such as Chinese civilization over the last 1,500 years or more, has generally communities which are both kinship and local. If a society has just kinship communities like Islamic civilization, it is in a very, very bad position. It never, for example, can understand the meaning of the word state. There is no real Arabic word for the state. And you may reach the point that the Arabs tended to reach, which was, since you trusted no one except your close relatives, the preferred marriage would be your parallel first cousin. That is, your father's brother's daughter is the one you must marry. Because no one else, and even then you don't trust her. All right. Now, of the four civilizations which came out of classical antiquity's wreckage, two of them clearly are a different kind of a civilization from ours, and I think Russia is too. What I'm saying is that I think those three, Islamic, Byzantine, and this I'm certain, and probably Russia also, are class B civilizations. That is, they continue to work for communities. I will take back about the Russia. Let's forget the Russia. It's a very much too complicated. We just looked at the Islamic and the Byzantine. On the other hand, Western civilization was different. The civilizations and the governments which appeared in class B civilizations, those which preserved communities, were governments of limited power. The chief powers that they had were raising money and recruiting soldiers. And they made no effort to deal with interpersonal relations or anything else. They were a kind of an empire. The finest example of that is the empire of Genghis Khan. But a very good example of it would be the Ottoman Empire, which is the final empire of Islamic civilization, which was destroyed in 1922, where you did not attempt to deal with the relationships of individuals, you left that to their local or their kinship communities. Now, before I get deeply into Western civilization, I want to say one more thing about classical antiquity. A moment ago, I said there would be difficulty talking to historians about this subject. The difficulties would be just as great in talking about classical history, a classical civilization, if I spoke to classicists. Classical civilization began with clans as the basic community. So where did this prove? At the beginning of classical civilization were kinship groups of clans, And at the beginning of our Western civilization were little self-sufficient villages across Europe in deep forests mostly, where these were of that isolated and different nature. Such communities are totalitarian. That is to say, everything that you get, which makes you a human being, you get from your community. But since in classical civilization, they gradually built up a state, and eventually a totalitarian state, one of the reasons they built up a totalitarian state is this. Classicists, for centuries, could not see that there was a difference between a society and a state. When Aristotle says, the polis, I won't translate it, the polis, P-O-L-I-S, is a koinonia, a community. He means a totalitarian group which gives you everything. He says, a man cut off from the polis is not a man. He just looks like a man. He's like a thumb cut off from a hand. It looks like a thumb, but it isn't. It's just a piece of meat. So the word polis in Aristotle and in Plato, and this is late, this is the 4th century, the society is already at least 6 centuries old. Now eventually the polis, of which there were many, was replaced by the imperium, of which there was one. But they continued to find it utterly impossible to see the distinction between the society in which you live, which gives you everything which makes you a man, rather than some kind of an animal, and the state, which has the monopoly or the large part of the political power in that society. So the polis, we say, was a city-state. It was a community, but it was also a state. And when they came to the imperium hundreds of years later, it was the same way. The imperium was a community. Now, in order to clarify this, I have to point out a few things. First, no other communities were approved of, and in many cases in Roman history, no other communities were permitted. Every society has what we might call the orthodox theory of the state for that society. And every society has the suppressed heresy of the state in that society. In the society of the classical antiquity, the orthodoxy was that the state is the community. And no one should desire any else. No one should desire a private life. Everybody's life should be public. Everyone should be prepared to give up anything, including his life, for the state, because the state is his community. And if he says, I'm going to go off and found my own commune, he, by that state, becomes a traitor. One of the first ones to do that was Epicurus, who was the 4th century BC. And Epicurus said all he wanted to do was to sit down in a quiet garden with his friends and talk and ignore politics. We're about to be approaching that in our society today. We haven't reached the point yet where it's about systemic. Because we are like classical antiquity. We're trying to, in our society, to grind down individuals into identical atoms in a mass culture in which all communities are disapproved. And if any community wishes to stand apart, we will go in by force and bust them out or bust them in or do anything that is necessary to make them become the kind of red-blooded Americans that all want to be. Now, then, the state in classical antiquity was totalitarian because it was regarded as a community. Now, once the classical civilization was gone, the whole configuration of civilized and cultural society in the West, that's the west of Eurasia, was transformed. Where the Mediterranean Sea had been the site of classical civilization, it became instead, by the year 700, the barrier between Arabic civilization, I'll do it from your point of view, there's the Mediterranean Sea, Arabic civilization to the south, Byzantine civilization to the northeast, Western civilization to the northwest. And the Mediterranean, instead of being an area of communication, became an area of frontier with a different society. A community is not easy to define, but I would define it approximately this way. If you trust everyone you meet automatically until they prove to be unworthy of trust, then you are in your community. On the other hand, if you distrust everyone you meet until they feel worthy of trust, then you are in an alien community. You're in Moscow or someplace like that. This would be a workable definition, it seems to me, of the two. Now, if I go back to the history of Western civilization, which began around 600, what we see is an effort being made after the civilization got started to establish the kind of totalitarian state structure which had been successfully established just about 600 in Byzantium, all which was established shortly after this, 1650, in the caliphate of Islamic civilization, all which was established at least by 600 or 700 BC in Sinic civilization. That is to say, forget now what my line of thought would be here. A kind of monarchy, which I will give you now as a parody. It's called providential monarchy. And it is associated with the idea of a providential deity. To watch the dead who shut religion off in a corner somewhere and insist that religion must not have anything to do with communities, or certainly nothing to do with politics, or business, or many, many other things, it is hard to have to grasp that one of the most potent things in establishing the structure of the state in any civilization has always been men's ideas of the nature of deity. And I would like to give you my parody for that. I will simply point out to you something which must be obvious to you. The deity, God, has many different attributes. He's creator, he's masculine, he's up, he's transcendental, that is, he's outside of the world of space and time, as established by 500 BC. Eventually, he's one. That Muhammad insisted on, God is one. And then that he is omnipotent, all powerful. Now I stop at this point. financial empires never got further than this. Now, the next thing that developed in our ideas of deities in Western civilization were that God is good. That was established by the prophets from the desert, certainly by the 5th century BC. And then came the Christian message that God is God. And then came the scholastic inference that God is pure reason by the year 1250 AD. Now, what you believe to be the nature of God in many civilizations, including our own, has helped to determine the structure of the society. And the crucial one I want to point out here is this. By 500 BC, in Western Asia, it was pretty well established that God is omnipotent. He can do anything. And there is nothing he cannot do. Thus, he is pure will. And at almost the same time came the other idea, which you find in Job, that God is good. But if God is good, he cannot do anything. He can only do things that are good. And if he can only do things that are good and cannot do things that are evil, then there is something higher than God. The rule of ethics. Thus, the great contribution, even before Christ, moving toward the Western idea of deity, was the idea of transcendental ethical monotheism. That God is love. And so forth. And it doesn't have sense. Now, if God is one, and God is all powerful, and he can do anything, and he is providential, which means he interferes in the world, then whatever happens in the world is because he permitted it. And whatever he permitted, who the hell is any ordinary human being to question it? Now, if you read Job, you'll see that this begins to come into that contradiction, that conversation, where Job is saying, God, you're running the world all wrong. You're letting bad people be elected president and so forth. Now, this is providential monarchy. Let me read what I wrote here about it. In providential monarchy, deity is, and it's Asiatic, heaven. Chinese word is jian, which means heaven. The idea in the original Indo-European was something like deus. Deus, from which Zeus came, and from which Zeus, which is Zeus, came, and so forth. It meant bright, brilliant sky. That was the deity. And this was a being of willful and arbitrary omnipotence. And if there is a ruler on earth, that ruler was picked by the deity. This means you must accept whatever happens. It leads, of course, as you can see, to fatalism, even though they don't accept that in their actions frequently. And the ruler is the vicar of omnipotent will on earth. Now, this has a number of things. There is no rule of law. There is a rule of God's will. This is the heresy of the West. And part of the heresy of the West. When the Crusades went to capture Jerusalem, And their war cry was, God hold it. They should have been rejected. This is not Western. Because the Western idea of this is God gives men and free will. And if he does evil things, he's responsible. And so forth. A totally different kind of thing. In the West, you get, accordingly, the rule of law. In providential monarchy, you do not get. You get the rule of will. And the slogan very quickly became, one God in heaven, one ruler on earth. Which meant that providential monarchs consistently tried to conquer the world. And these are the great world conquerors. And I've already said Genghis Khan was the greatest of them. And very much worth studying. His government, his army, his whole attitude is a magnificent machine for world conquest and world rule as the vicar of heaven on earth. There are no constitutional rules of political succession in a providential monarchy. There are no constitutional rules of succession. In Islamic civilization, in Byzantine civilization, or in Russian civilization, ever. And to talk about constitutional law in Russia is top notch. Even right up to the end, there was no constitutional rule of succession. Alexander I left a note in his death saying that he wanted his second or third son, I forget which one it was, his second son, I believe, to be his successor. And that's it. That was an act of will, not an act of constitutional law. And this is the day, of course, in Russia today. Notice it's true in China. It always was true in China. China was a providential monarchy. But in the West, where we have the rule of law, where even God is under rules, the rules of ethics, you have a totally different situation, and you expect to have constitutional rules of political action, including the rules of political succession. Now, the Carolingian Empire, it was built up in the course of 200 years approximately, let's say 687 to 887 approximately, 200 years, was an attempt to impose in the West a providential monarchy which was a heresy, not in terms of the West's beliefs at the time, but in terms of the belief which were intrinsic in the nature of Western thought, including our belief in Christ. And in both of the Testaments. And while everyone that I read is full of praise about Charlemagne, Charlemagne was that kind of a willful man trying to do something that was impossible to do. Which was to conquer practically the whole world. And he failed. The reason he failed was that he was doing it in a period of constantly deepening economic depression. And as a result of constant deepening economic depression, it became less and less possible even to conquer all the provinces of his own empire, and totally impossible to rule the provinces of his own empire. Because as the depression became worse and worse and worse, transportation broke down, all bridges collapsed, aggressive magnificent accounts of somebody trying to go from Chartres to Paris, and drive this in about half an hour, I guess, if I don't know, for instance, traffic.
And it took him something like 11 days. When he was up there, the horse died of exhaustion. And they had to do such things as try and catch hold of bridges by taking the shield so the horse could fall through and so forth. All right, all commerce disappeared. Everybody was reduced to living off of the piece of land they were on, and this became the communities which are the root organizational patterns of the West. The local communities, call it the parish, the village, or the manor, whatever you want, it's local, and it's self-sufficient. And one of the chief reasons that you could not, and Charlemagne could not, conquer great distance was it became economically impossible to capture any fortified building. Because you couldn't stay there long enough, you couldn't take enough men and enough food there to starve off the people inside, because anybody inside would have more food on hand than you could carry. And if you carried a small amount of food, then you had to take a small number of men, in that case, they'd come out and chase you away. So, we got then, after Charlemagne, the last Carolingian is 887, he was removed for not fighting the Vikings sufficiently vigorously. And for 100 years, there was no ruler. Instead, the whole society, and we call this a dark age. There is nothing wrong with a dark age. Dark ages are, in many cases, the most productive period in the history of any civilization. And certainly Western civilization they were. Any of you have read Lynn White's book on the technological advances of the dark ages, such as the plow and so forth, and harnessing, and so forth and so forth, know that we got a great deal. But out of the dark age that followed the collapse of the Carolingian Empire, we got the most magnificent thing which we have in our society. The recognition that people can have a society without having a state. In other words, the recognition that people can have a society without having a state. In other words, it's wiped away by experience, the assumption that is found all through classical antiquity, except by unorthodox and heretical thinking, that the state and the society are identical, and that a state such as the imperium must be a society, therefore you can desire nothing more than to be a citizen. And if you want to go down in a ghetto or catacomb and be with your cozy co-believers and so forth, then you are an enemy. Because you are violating the fundamental assumption. Now, again, to get to the structure of this document. The Mediterranean has become a barrier. In the north, much neglected in our history books, but of vital importance, the Vikings were pouring outward. Before 750, they were pouring outward. Raiders, slaves, pirates, men of violence, and virility. And as you know, they occupied Iceland, and they settled in Greenland, and Newfoundland, and so forth. And they went eastward too, into Russia, and started the beginnings of Russian civilization. Now I call this Northern Monarchy. It started as individual groups of pirate raiders. But it ended up, and that would be from 750 or so to 930. Then there was a brief lull. From 980 for 1,000 years to about 1080,
they were coming out as monarchies.
That is organized state structure. We call this Roman monarchy. I invented the title and had certain definite ideas. Where those ideas came from, I do not know. And it hasn't been discussed. It's possible that they got some of them from Byzantium, because the Vikings went across Russia all the way to the Black Sea and Byzantine. It's possible that they got it from the Carolingians, from the enemy, the Carolingians. But notice the extraordinary thing about the Vikings, I can't spend too much time on that, that they went so far that they surrounded Europe. That is to say, the Vikings didn't just go to Newfoundland, places like that. They conquered Normandy in 911. They had conquered England several times, most recently in 1066. They had gone down and conquered southern Italy and Sicily. They had gone into Russia, and it opened up the trade across Russia from the north down to the south. They had even attacked Constantinople and eventually had become the highest mercenary. And the extraordinary thing is this, that in the battle in 1018 in southern Italy, Normans of Viking descent fighting on the side of the Pope were in battle with so-called Varangians of Viking descent fighting in behalf of the Byzantine Empire. So there they had gone all the way around and were fighting. That Northern monarchy is of very great significance and had things which seem very imposing. For example, it raised a military force and it raised taxes on the basis of assessment on plots of land, which in England we call hides, but they have different names, they're found in Russia too. They had standing armies. Archaeologists recently, that is to say in the last 25 years, have found three large camps in Denmark, built about the year 1000 by the king Sven Forkbeard, where his standing army was ready at any moment to embark in the ship and go off. The success of the Vikings, like the success of the raiders of the steppes of Asia, was in mobility. But where the steppes of Asia mobility was based on horseback riding with an excellent weapon, the composite bow, the threat of the Vikings was their mobility on water. And they also had missile weapons. But by the year 1000, in Western Europe, you had a two-class society. Peasants, who produced food, and then a small percentage of fighters who fought on horseback with sharp weapons. In Europe, that is, with spears. And who, if they were lucky, had a fortified house in which to live. That's all they needed. So you have a two-class society. Now, eventually, that two-class society began to develop. And when they come to the year 1150, we find that there a new class has appeared as a separate class, the clergy. I won't say how this happened. So what you have is a monarch at the top. You have the nobility, who have weapons. You have the clergy. And you have the peasants at the bottom. But as I say, by the middle of the 12th century, you also have the beginnings of commerce, the rise of towns, the appearance of a middle class of commercial traders. So you have commercial traders. What the king did at the top was build up a bureaucracy. That is, people who could write, keep records, to handle cases of justice in his court, to keep track of the money he could raise in his treasury, and he built up these. Now there's the king, there is a few lords, Cal, there are the clergy, there are the bourgeoisie, the middle class, and there are the peasants who are out of it, all through this, they're out of it. They never paid, they never have played any major political role. At first the king used the clergy to gradually take away from the lords, the fighting men, powers that would make him stronger and stronger to build up his bureaucracy by doing it. But soon he discovered you can't trust the clergy. They are frequently much too loyal to the bishop or even to the pope. By that time, according to the king, he built up his bureaucracy out of the bourgeoisie. He took the sons of middle class, town dwelling, commercial people who could read and write and count, and put them in his bureaucracy. And this meant that you had the king of the bureaucracy recruiting and to some extent obtaining financial support from the bureaucracy, from the bourgeoisie. And it meant that the feudal lords and at least the upper clergy tended to come together and to cooperate in resistance to this. A hundred years after the last Carolingian died in 887, a microscopic lord near Paris was permitted by the seven or eight great lords who surrounded him, much more powerful than he was, to take the royal title. His name was Hugh Capet. The date is 987. Hugh Capet was the first of the Capetian kings, and he was allowed to take that title because he was so weak. They would not have permitted anyone with any strength. In fact, the title of king, he was also allowed to take the title of suzerain, which means he was the top man in the feudal system. I will not attempt to define the feudal system if you don't know. So here the suzerain is combined with the king in a man who had no power, and it was done because he was pious and religious and weak. Now, as suzerain, he didn't have the power of a real suzerain. A suzerain is simply a feudal lord that has no feudal lord above him. Because the feudal lords below him, who were technically his vassals, did not perform military service, did not come to his court to settle disputes, and had very little to do with it. But nevertheless, the power of his religious aura allowed him gradually to accumulate more and more and more power. Now, I want to say a few words about the title of king. King is a religious title. It means a ruler who has been consecrated with holy oils by an archbishop in an archiepiscopal cathedral. It's a ceremony very simple, similar to the sacrament of confirmation. You're anointed with holy oil, and you thus become a kind of a special thing. This power and king allowed him to assume certain things, such as the king should see that everyone gets justice. The king should see that everyone gets protection. The king's peace, in other words. He must seek justice on earth with God's blessing.
To the vassals, that meant that the Capetians should provide ethical and moral support for their individual political rights, which to them was exactly what they wanted. The interesting thing is that in 1792, when Louis XVI was going to the scaffold in the French Revolution, he still believed this, that the obligation that he had as a king was to support the rights of everyone, including the nobles and the church. So it was a powerful feeling. This was the central core of the old regime, and it cannot be emphasized too much. The king is the source of justice. Now, with this, I want to combine something else which is difficult, perhaps. The idea of property in classical antiquity we sum up in the word proprietas. It means possessing all the innumerable and unnumerable rights in an object, maybe with a few specific restraints. In other words, you have a car that will drive 150 miles an hour, but you're not supposed to drive 150 miles an hour. That's your car. And you can drive it not, but if you drive it and rent it, you can sell it. Rent. In other words, that's proprietas. Proprietas is the sum of innumerable and undesignated rights in an object. This was not the medieval idea of property. The medieval idea of property was specific rights. And the word that we use is dominia, D-O-M-I-N-I-A, which is plural, meaning rights. Now, the obligation of the Capetian king was to preserve everyone's dominion. This meant that if there is an object, a piece of land, and a dozen people have certain rights on it, his job is to preserve their rights. And this includes, since he's under the law, his own property. Because it isn't his, it's the monarchy's, it's the family's. This means he cannot alienate his own property. It isn't his own. He cannot alienate the domain, we call it, the property of the monarchy. He gradually was assuming the dimly remembered powers that monarchy had had in the past. To coin money, to call out the whole people for military service in an emergency, to see that all men lived in peace and had justice, to grant municipalities rights of self-government, or to recognize specifically their rights of self-government, to protect the church and religion, to regulate commerce, particularly exports, so that there would be no shortage of food for the people. There are six things which were incumbent upon him as king. The last four of these are what in French public law is known as la police, the policy. That is, administrative power to use discretion in an emergency or a complicated social situation. Now, building up these, one of the greatest assets which the Capetians had was that for eight generations they produced sons. From 987 to 1328, they produced sons. And in 1328, when they didn't produce sons, there were brothers. In fact, it first started in 1814. There were several brothers, and the brothers had sons. The much more powerful feudal lords which surrounded the Capetian Duke of France originally did not have so much luck. For one thing, they took a lot of risks. They went off to the Crusades and things like that. And as their families died out and they had no heirs, a right that existed to the king as sovereign was exercised. This is the right of escheat. That if a territory, a group of dominion,
to the king who can give it out to someone else. In this way, the kings were able gradually, and it took them till 1493, to get the territorial unity of France. But in getting the territorial unity of France, they didn't get the power in those territories. They simply replaced the existing laws, and because they were king, because they were in the obligation to preserve everyone's dominia, they were even less powerful when they became Duke of Normandy, Count of Flanders, Count of Anjou, Duke of Burgundy, or any of these other titles that were gradually accumulating. They were less powerful in those appanages, we call them, those territories, than the rulers that they were replacing, who were not under the obligation to be that law-abiding and that subject to the rules of what is right. There grew up then gradually a legalized confusion of extremely limited sovereignty. Because any act that a person did which was profitable or advantageous to him, if he did it long enough, he acquired a right to do it. We have in this in English law, this is called the right of prescription. But in English law, the right of prescription does not run against the state. In other words, if you do something and you do it for 30 years, you may have the right to do it against a private person who has private property. But you do not have such a right against the state. You may notice that every few years, and the Rockefeller Center in New York is broke off and you're not allowed to walk between the buildings. This is to break your prescriptive right to walk across between the buildings. From 1338 to 1453. And in this, the king obtained royal taxation, a royal army, and a royal system of justice. We got something which is typical of the West, the rule of lawyers and judges. And there were three periods in the history of the West in which we have been overwhelmed by lawyers and judges who tell us again and again that you cannot do certain things because of the legal, even if these things are absolutely essential to be done. That would be from 1350 to about 1480 or so, such a period. Again, from about 1690 through the French Revolution, 1789, was a revolt against this mass of rules legalistic couldn't do it. Where judges and lawyers are running everything, and we are obsessed by it. But it's part of the tradition of the West, and it goes back, and the French Revolution is, of course, the violent response to that situation. Now, after about 1370, let me much more brief. The attempt to conquer France was hopeless. They could win battles, but they could go territory. Eventually, all they did was go out and plunder, kill people, burn villages, seize rich people, demand ransom, and so forth and so forth, living off the country, and they were living. If they punished the French in this way, the French people would realize the King of France would not protect them, and therefore they should turn their allegiance to the King of England. And recognize the King of France. Said in this, because what the French people up to that point had been thinking was that the local law should protect increased his speed in such things as Joan of Arc, 1429, who summoned the whole religious loyalty and allegiance of France to a very considerable degree to focus it on this pious weakling, I suppose, in many ways, the tyrant man, the so-called Dauphin. And he insisted that he must go to France and be coronated. And he insisted that if everybody rallied, they would go out to be English. Well, the English were thrown out in about 25 years. That king, Charles VII, I think is one of the most important French kings, although this is not widely recognized. 2 years ago, a new biography of him appeared in English, and it is almost worth it. By a lady named Strayhorn, notice he was king, technically, I suppose, from 1422 to 1461, and the war ended in 1453, although they didn't have a peace treaty until 1492, I believe it was. So he had a number of years after the war ended, in which he was king. And what he did, he tried to solidify the dominion of France in the way that they should be kept, because that was the custom, and that is the right of everyone. To do this, he did a number of things. He established a royal army with a systematic system of taxation to support it. But two other things are much more important. In the Pragmatic Sanction of Bourges, 1438, he codified the rights of the church in France, and these were the rights of the church in France against the king, as well as against the Pope. An autonomous church, electing its own members, its own bishops, controlling its own property, and so forth. That's 1438, but war was still going on. And then in 1457, 4 years after the war, he issued, and this is amazing, he issued an edict, Montillo Latour, M-O-N-T-I-L-L-E-T-U-R. I don't find the nation in most history books. It certainly is the most important edict copy that was in the old regime. It was an order for every locality to write down the local customs. It took 150 years to do it, and then it was revived. But by 1580, which is when we're talking, there were 365 law codes of the local customs in France, and these were the binding laws which meant he had condemned France to what we would call legal disunity. So although he had territorial unity, he had every other kind of legal disunity. Taxes were different everywhere because the way it was customary to do it. There were tolls preventing farmers from moving everywhere. There was no unity of the judicial system. At one time, there were 14 supreme courts. And this disunified condition was the condition which led inevitably to the French Revolution. Although it took hundreds of years to reach that inevitable fact. Never look back to sin. No monastery in 1789 could survive which had different systems of weights and measures for every commodity in every village practically or in every district, which had different laws. So as Voltaire said, you change law every time you change your folklore. which had conflicting jurisdictions, which had different rates of pay, so that rich paid nothing in taxes and poor paid a great deal, another place the rich paid a great deal. I mean, it was just chaos, because whatever was custom, and under the prescriptive right, that custom was dominion, and dominion was the law. And as a result, in 1789, we find a solution to a problem which, when I was younger than even the students were here, struck me right from the age. I always had the eye of a child. I said, if the King of France is absolute, in 1789, all books say what, how could he be bankrupt? Unless the country was bankrupt. And no one claims that France was bankrupt in 1789. France was among the wealthy countries of Europe. So if the king is absolute, there's no reason why he could use that good power to raise the money that he needs from a wealthy economic system such as existed in France. This is one of the reasons I studied this subject. And what I found was that the king of France was not absolute. He was not even sovereign, and indeed, he had reached perhaps the peak of his power around 1520, and by 1576, when we're ending this lecture, already his power was collapsing. And it collapsed into a growing morass of increasingly shrinking restraint. I'll give you one example, and then the king could not borrow because he had no collateral. If everything he has belongs to Barnaby and doesn't belong to him, then he cannot put up any of these royal possessions as collateral on loan. He says, I'd like to borrow 100,000 livres. And someone says, well, what can you put up? Well, if he could get a necklace or something from the queen, that wasn't part of the royal dominion, that might be all right. But he had to borrow millions. So he had no credit. What he did was, for centuries, he couldn't alienate property, so he alienated incomes. And by 1789, every income that he had coming in had already committed to some expense. So his ancestors, he said to someone, I want you to do this, and if you do this, you can take this income from this place. And he gave it about that. So when he wanted to borrow money, he could say, all right, there's any money. He would say, I'll never pay it back, but I will pay the interest on it. And in this interest, from this income, which has just come free, because the family that's been getting it for 300 years has died out, and now this income is free, it yields, let us say, 100,000 a year, and at 10% interest, you will give me 1,000,000. And then you'll have 100,000 a year. And if you ever want your money, you can always sell an income of 100,000 a year to anybody for 1,000,000. Now, he had to find in 1561 enormous sums of money. I won't explain how he got so badly yet, they can. And what he did was, the city of Paris said that they would do it. They would guarantee these loans that were given to him, but they needed guarantees the interest would be paid. And the Church of France volunteered to pay the interest. These are called banquets, do the other deal to pay. This made within 150 years, the Church of France stronger and more of a sovereign political entity than the monarchy itself. But we'll have to say that the next. win. Thank you, David.
I'd like to thank Professor Quigley for his lecture, his reference to the Northern monarchy and the Danes. Reminds me that we have a very distinguished guest in our audience from Denmark, Professor Erling Due, who is visiting the United States on a bicentennial lecture tour for Denmark. And his visit is timed to coincide with the 175th anniversary of continuous diplomatic relations between Denmark and the United States, which is the longest unbroken continuous record of diplomatic relations of any country with which the United States has had diplomatic relations. Professor Buell, could you rise and be recognized? Professor Buell is here not only as our guest, but as a student of Professor Quigley's himself. He, too, is an historian and a professor of international relations and has written a book somewhat reminiscent of Professor Quigley's own, The World Since 1945. Also, I'm very pleased that Professor Quigley made some reference to providential deity, because Dorothy Brown, on the way over here, mentioned that some years ago she had seen a poster in the Walsh Building that read, "Jesus loves you." And beneath it, a student had written, "If that is so, why did Professor Quigley give me an F?" I hope that student was here this evening to learn that there is no logical inconsistency between Jesus' love and a Quigley F. I hope you will return and join us next Wednesday, same location, same time, same Professor Quigley.